Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We return to this important speech by the legendary Wes Jackson of the Land Institute. Wes explains how we might use natural techniques to produce food without fossil fuels and helping climate change. Afterwards, we'll talk about carbon to soil and biochar with Australian scientist Dr. Michael Ropak. This speech by Wes Jackson was recorded at ASPO 2011 in Washington by Jerry Williams of Radio EcoShock.
So, what happened 10,000 years ago? At the eastern end of the Mediterranean, it's drying out. The ice is receding. And over in the Zagros Mountains of western Iran, a species, the wheat plant, they started cultivating it. And that was an annual, not a perennial, grown in monocultures. In order for that seed to be able to germinate, nature had to be subdued or ignored. So 70% of our calories come from grains. Number one crop is rice. It's number two in acreage. This is of the planet now. Number two crop is wheat. It's number one in acreage. Number three is corn. Then we have potato, but after that it's the grains again. Humans are primarily grass seed eaters and secondarily legume seed eaters. 70% of our calories from roughly 67-68% of the agricultural acreage devoted to annual monocultures. And in order to do that, this idea that nature's to be subdued or ignored has ricocheted through civilization at many levels and even informs the technological fundamentalism that's rampant in our world today. So, starting in 1977, it looked to me like reading the General Accounting Office report that soil erosion was as bad in 77 as when the Soil Conservation Service was formed in the 30s. And after taking my students on a field trip to the Kansa Prairie and noting the soil erosion all around me, I wondered, why can't we build an agriculture based on perennial grains grown in mixtures and take advantage of the efficiencies that are inherent within those natural integrities? And so we're mostly plant breeders at the Land Institute, and we have some bright young PhDs that learned a lot more than I did in graduate school in genetics. They got so many more techniques available to them. And so among the things we're doing is crossing wheat with wild relatives. We get hybrids. We do most of this hybridization in the greenhouse at the Land. We have a total of 31 staff, 39 in the summertime. So we've got quite a few hands at work. We do what's called chromosome painting, if necessary. And the one color of chromosome came from one species, the other color from another. That'll tell us what kind of a chromosomal balance we have. We use molecular markers. By the way, this is to impress you, not inform you. And sometimes we make a hybrid, and when we do, it'll form an embryo, but not the endosperm. And so we rescue the embryo and put it on a gel. Then we can get this hybrid that we can then back cross in either direction and often, usually, reestablish the endosperm. So we rescue more embryos than anybody in the state of Kansas. We're pro-life at the Land Institute. And here represent some of our hybrids that you see. They've been harvested, and here they are shooting up. So we say, okay, that's something we want to look at more carefully. But notice how many of them out there did not send up shoots. Of almost 2,000 plants, 43% survived the summer of 10. So we're selecting pretty rigorously for those that can make it. And we've got germplasm in Australia, several countries around the world. These are some plots of Cicero in New South Wales. Those are some of our plants. In Nepal. And then here is just a field trial of some of our what we call Kernza. We named its Thenopyrum intermedium. We gave it the name Kernza, Kansas, Kansa Indians, Colonel, and anything with a Z in it is more memorable.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with Dr. Wes Jackson, answering the challenge of feeding the world with declining fossil fuel resources in a climate-changed world.
The plant on your right is the species that started civilization. And imagine the vegetative structure that had to be destroyed below ground as well as above ground that then opened our landscapes to soil erosion. The plant on the left is our Kernza. And here's some flower. So it'll be about 9 or 10 years before that's farmer ready. When I first published on this in 78, I said, this is 50 to 100 years. Well, we're on schedule. At that time, folks were saying, my golly, that's too long. Can we wait around that long? But now with climate change, the population problem, we're suddenly in the short solution category. Our motto at the land has been, if you're working on something you can finish in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. I think that's something we all got to think about really hard. As far as this ever becomes being fulfilled, I'll be good on the harp. Well, there you can see the contrast. Imagine in September on the left now, we plant the wheat. You can't even see the grain. December, the wheat plants a little bit along. March, it's along. By June, it still doesn't get to be as long as the Kernza. So imagine when we came across this continent, cutting the forests and plowing the prairies. Imagine as we went through plowing that prairie, they said it sounded like the opening of a zipper. Imagine what we were destroying. That, in my view, is the carbon that is more important in the soil than in the gas tank. And that's some of the carbon that would be translocated to the gas tank. Wendell Berry says, as we came across the continent, cutting the forests, plowing the prairies, we've never known what we were doing because we've never known what we were undoing. We were undoing an original relationship with the planet, millions and millions of years old ecosystem, and now we need to perennialize corn. This is some of our work with the sorghum, and we now have winter hardy perennial sorghum. Still a lot of breeding to do, though. Also, sunflowers, very important oilseed crop. Makes the top 20, it's amazing. Here you can see we already have the big head on one of our perennials. And working with another closely related species. Here we are also, two of our guys are right now in China. We're supporting the perennialization of the upland rice. Stan Cox and Lee Di Han. This is something that's developed in those areas in the uplands where they have that upland rice, where they'll destroy the original vegetative structure, maybe get a crop for a couple of years, and then that's it. So here is in Yunnan province some of the rices. Okay, so we could go on and on about our breeding work. If we can keep ourselves fed, agriculture is the number one threat to wild biodiversity. But given the desecration of our ag lands worldwide and our dependency on fossil fuels, what do? We can introduce the ecosystem concept. Think of it this way, folks. For 10,000 years, we have not been able to use the ecosystem concept because tearing the ground up every year, the ecological processes don't have a chance. It's like clear cutting. But now, with the perennials on the horizon, we can begin to imagine. Here's the story. Darwin gave us the unification of biology. Darwin is the most important biologist since Aristotle. He brought together biologists in anatomy, morphology, all sorts of things, and it came right out of a natural history tradition. Darwin is 1859, the same year as Drake's oil well, the same year that John Brown is hanged at Harper's Ferry. That's another connection. There's another lecture there. Darwin, without soil carbon, forest carbon, and coal, we'd have never had him. I promise you I won't go any more about that. But it's wonderfully interesting about 1859 and what was happening then. Because a little over 100 years before that is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And also, remember, it's like 1865 that we have the coal question written. You all know about the coal question? Jevons paradox. He found that as industrial England got more efficient with its technology, industrial England used more resources, particularly coal and iron. And that's something we need to come to, well, frees up capital, but something we need to come to grips with. Now, another long breath. Am I all right? Just a little bit?
4 minutes.
4 minutes? Oh, my God. Here is the hierarchy of structure. Atoms, molecules, cells, tissues, organs, organisms, ecosystem, ecosphere. Since around 1600, we've increasingly looked downward in a more reductive approach to solve our problems. And right now, we have two molecules that we're using to deal with the soil erosion problem. The molecule of Roundup Ready and the molecule for resistance to Roundup. But we're saying upward in that hierarchy, being put on the shelf over 100 years, and especially since 1980, the long-term ecological research sites, 26 of them around the country, ecologists have been putting on the shelf for its own sake because they have the luxury to be descriptive, while the agriculturists have had the burden to be prescriptive. We have not been able to bring all that body of knowledge to inform a research agenda for agriculture. And so, does this idea have legs? Yes, a conference in Australia. Agriculture is a mimic of natural ecosystems. And so, three of us took to the U.S. Department of Agriculture what we call the 50-year farm bill. And we said, look, for $50 million a year, spread over 50 years, we can build an agriculture, and that will be a conceptual revolution more important than the Copernican Revolution, which we didn't need when we got it. It's all right now. But so what? We still say the sun's coming up. We don't seem to get it. So the 50-year farm bill, though, would be saving the soil resources and the water resources and eliminate the toxics. And here's what it looked like. Here's the 328 million acres of agricultural land in the U.S., and 80% of it is annuals, 20% perennials. So we're wanting to use the 5-year farm bills as mileposts to get that reversed over a 50-year period. So the brown part, those are the vegetables and the fruits, the things that make up the sustainable ag movement. They're only around 4% of our total land. But then the yellow are the grains, and then the green are the pastures that may be in a rotation, some perennials in rotation. So where the blue kicks in is when our perennials become ready. And then where it's hatched on the blue, that is, those will also be grazed. So I'm going to move because I'm out of time. Yeah. Oh. All right. How do we manage this? Fire, grazing. These are our 30 head of bison on our 160 acres of prairie. That's our standard. If we want to know what to do, we go to find out what the prairie is doing. So here is the domestic bovine. Here, and by the way, that domestic bovine is a selective grazer. and the management of these perennial polyculture grain crops in the future will require some selective grazing, but they will also require the non-selective grazer. This is where the biofuels ought to be used and nowhere else. So the next synthesis, Darwin gave us the first synthesis. Dobzhansky in 1937 wrote the book Genetics and the Origin of Species. We didn't have a good theory of heredity. Darwin didn't. But now, after there's been a synthesis, there's been a flowering. And then the next was 1953, Watson and Crick and the Molecular. Genetics, evolution with the modern molecular synthesis. Now we have that tremendous body of knowledge available to go to work. So what we're calling for is the foundation world over a 30-year period to spend $1.64 billion educating 110 PhD-level scientists that would be positioned around the world to bring on a sustainable green revolution. Each one of them would have a technician. Each would have support staff. And they are to be mission-oriented and to not be detracted by the here and now. But, yes, let the here and now folk interact, and there will be interaction both ways and again. But, by and large, keep it straight that this is mission-oriented research for a planet whose food-producing system is in decline. So, that's it.
That was Dr. Wes Jackson, founder of the Land Institute at landinstitute.org. The speech was recorded in Washington, D.C. at the ASPL USA Conference, November 4, 2011, by Jerry Williams of Radio EcoShock. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil for this presentation. Lately on Radio EcoShock, we've talked about sequestering carbon back into the soil using different farming techniques. I checked with my longtime email correspondent and super paleoclimatologist from Australia, Dr. Andrew Glickson. Andrew said, you have to ask Dr. Michael Ropak. He's the best on carbon cycles. We have Michael Ropak on the line from Adelaide. He's the longtime science leader, researcher, and fellow of CSIRO. That is the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. It is Australia's National Science Agency. Dr. Ropak, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure, Alex.
Michael Ropak, I called about the carbon cycle and the proposals to take more carbon into the soil with better farming. What methods have you heard about, and is this a serious possibility to help solve the climate crisis?
That's a very good question. Before we come to the issue of what methods, let's just talk about soil carbon and its potential role as a sink. The first thing we have to recognise is that there's a huge amount of carbon in the world's soils, something like three times the total amount that there is in the atmosphere. So you would think on that basis that there's a possibility to just slightly increase that amount, the total amount of carbon in the world's soils, and lo and behold, we've extracted a huge amount from the atmosphere in order to do that. It's not actually that simple, because there's, in reality, a continual exchange of carbon between soils and the atmosphere. If left to themselves, soil carbon in any given system, be it a forest or a grassland or an agricultural system, will reach a natural level which is in a kind of equilibrium with the other ecosystem processes or the management processes that are happening on that land. So when we talk about increasing soil carbon, we're talking about somehow changing those processes that determine that equilibrium in a way that will tip the equilibrium, not just for a few years, but essentially forever. Because if we reverse that change in the processes that are altering the equilibrium and allow them to go back to what they were before, all the carbon comes straight back out again and we go back to where we were before. So...
Well, the proponents suggest that the development of modern agriculture and exposing soils and plowing it and so on have really lessened not only the amount of soil that we have, but also the nutrients and the carbon in that soil. So they're thinking if we could Well, first of all, they're saying there's been a general loss of carbon in the soils over the ages since agriculture was developed. Do we have science to back that up?
To some extent, we do. There are studies which demonstrate that in some systems, changing practices from, for instance, land clearing in order to take away forests and introduce agriculture has decreased the total amount of carbon in the landscape. Some of that's the loss of carbon in wood from the trees as they decay or are burned or whatever, and that carbon ends up in the atmosphere. Some of it's soil carbon. Studies, however, are a bit, they go both ways. There are some studies which suggest that the total soil carbon content in forests is not all that different from the soil carbon content in well-maintained agricultural systems, which have been set up as the landscape is cleared. Now, certainly in many semi-arid environments, if the agricultural systems are not good and if the land is allowed to seriously degrade, then most certainly there's a significant loss of soil carbon and nutrients. But the nutrients, of course, go with soil carbon. That's another part of the puzzle that we have to think about carefully. But the overall story is that there has been a loss of carbon from forests as they're cleared to go to grassland. Much of that loss is associated with the wood. The component that's associated with the soil can go both ways. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes negative, depending on the exact details of the change.
And I think one of the other acknowledged weaknesses of the agricultural method is the requirement to change age-old habits in millions of farmers, plus the new industrialized methods of profit-making corporations. The communications and training problems are immense, and I'm wondering whether that disqualifies this as a solution to averting the worst of climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Now, the question of sequestering carbon in landscapes, and in my view, that's a much more uncertain story. The extent to which carbon can be sequestered and can be done in ways that make it trackable and accountable and capable of being measured, that's much more difficult. But I think that committing to major changes in soil carbon across the world as a significant sequestration strategy in order to bring emissions under control is fraught with danger.
But NASA's James Hansen has suggested biochar might work. What are your thoughts on biochar?
Well, a study published in Nature a couple of years ago suggested that biochar, at the very most, could contribute a mitigation potential of about 10% of what's required. In other words, that over the next, let's say, 50 years, the largest conceivable biochar program would contribute something like 10%, what's sometimes called a wedge of 10% of the emissions mitigation needs to be brought about by then. Now, 10% is significant, but we have to look at the costs that are that may be associated with that. And biochar as a strategy involves the large-scale diversion of wastes, of agricultural and forest production wastes, into plants which can be factories, essentially, which convert this into a combination of gas which has some energy potential and char which can be put back onto landscapes. The costs of doing this need to be weighed up against the benefits, and those costs include potential diversions of agricultural and other forms of land to service a biochar industry, potentially reducing their ability to produce food. And of course, food is, along with mitigating climate change, producing food is a major requirement, something that's indispensable over the coming decades. So we need to be careful both about the magnitudes of a biochar industry and the possible side effects of it. I think there has been some tendency in the last few years to see biochar as a magic cure. In this game, there are no magic cures. And anybody who says, we can fix this with biochar, and in my own country, there are a number of people who are making claims of that sort. Those claims simply don't stack up against the reality.
And I can see another hurdle, and that's the changes in the hydrological cycle. As the world warms, we have projections showing desertification over some of the world's subtropical regions, and Australia has suffered terribly in its agriculture. Maybe it's too late to try agricultural sequestration in some areas.
Well, I think agricultural sequestration, in essence, is a side benefit of other changes that we're going to need to make in production systems. And it may be a side cost in some circumstances. So I really think we should take agricultural sequestration largely out of the equation in terms of our long-term thinking about emissions mitigation. The way we should be reducing our emissions is through reducing the use of carbon-based fossil fuels for energy. We should be conserving. We should be doing all of these actions which are necessary in order to bring this curve of emissions that have been increasing at 3% per year over the last decade back down to steady, and then in a very few years to reducing at something like 3% per year. Those steps require us to address the fossil fuel-based side of this entire picture. And I feel that a stress on sequestration as a mitigation potential for mitigation reasons is diverting an enormous amount of energy from that central task.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Michael Ropak from Australia's National Science Agency, CSIRO. We're talking about places Earth could store our excess carbon dioxide.
I think the overwhelming message, if we return to the question of soil carbon, is that of balance. At the moment, we have an Earth system which is significantly unbalanced from the point of view of the planet. The major unbalance is occurring because of emissions of fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases into the Earth system. Our challenge over the coming century is to get things back into balance. And how we do that is largely going to be by reducing the forces, the drivers that have sent things out of balance, rather than by attempting to put compensations back into the system. So one big example of an attempt to restore balance in some sense by compensating somewhere else would be geoengineering. I think geoengineering, from almost every point of view, is not a good idea. We don't know enough about the system we're trying to engineer. It would have enormous disbenefits, enormous costs, as well as the benefits that it's supposed to be having. It would commit us, as a human species, to effectively steering the Earth system, which we don't properly understand, to achieve some sort of balance, which is a long way away from the one to which the Earth system would tend naturally if left to itself from the point of view of climate, CO2 and so on. This, I think, is enormously dangerous. And given how much we don't understand about the Earth system, given the fact that we know that climate varies enormously, you know, we look back over hundreds of thousands of years and we see the massive changes in climate that have occurred through the ice ages. We don't understand enough about the system to be confident that we can control it and have it avoid running off the rails in some sense that would be catastrophic for humanity. A very famous climatologist said once that people used to have the view that climate is a benign and trustworthy state of affairs for the world. The view, as we look back over those hundreds of thousands of years, is that climate, in fact, tends to be something like an angry beast, and if provoked, can lash back in all kinds of unexpected ways. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why we should be very hesitant about trying to manage the climate system with geoengineering strategies, which would have us locked into, in one sense, managing this angry beast.
We have been talking with Dr. Michael Ropak, researcher and fellow of CSIRO, the Australian National Science Agency. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your time and this insight.
Pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. And don't forget our program from November 30th, 2011, where Dr. Alan Savory described his award-winning method to move carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. Download that and all our past programs from our website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining us this week.